Thank you very much, everybody. I'm going to talk a little bit about funding social infrastructure in the current economic climate. Firstly, I thought I'd talk a little bit about what is social infrastructure. I think most of us know what that is, but I thought I'd just recap that. There's been lots of talk about the Great Depression, and I think what we're about to experience or are experiencing is the Great Deleveraging, and I'll explain a little bit about what I think that means and what it means for government. A little bit about the whys and hows of procuring infrastructure. I've obviously heard a little bit about that already this morning. And then focus a bit more on the actual sort of funding of infrastructure, the issue of competition and competition with funding or for funding, and then touch obviously on the two main parts of that funding equation, both debt and equity. Social infrastructure, I think everybody probably knows what that is, but what I'm talking about is availability payments, performance-based infrastructure with limited demand or usage risk. It's traditionally obviously been applied to hospitals, schools, justice facilities, other civic infrastructure like the Melbourne Convention Centre, which is being developed here. And increasingly we're seeing it applied to water, to roads, and even now to mass transit. What I'm not talking about when I make my comments around funding is about toll roads, airports, or any of the market-based utilities. I'm not going to spend too much time just talking about the economic climate. We all know about that. Obviously there was a massive increase in leverage across the globe over the last sort of 15 or so years. Unfortunately, the banks were amongst the worst culprits. Usually the banks sort of operate as a bit of a buffer between the economy and over the cycles. And I've obviously picked out a few easy targets there, but some of the sort of leverage levels that some of the banks got to was quite extraordinary. We're now experiencing a massive sort of deleveraging process, which, as everybody would appreciate, is very difficult to control and is potentially has very severe economic consequences, as I think people are obviously experiencing. This chart just sort of shows what's happened in the US over the last sort of 50 years or so. You can see GDP, the black line, public sector indebtedness being the blue line, and that generally tracks along something less than GDP. And then the green line is what the private sector have been binging on, and you can see the massive, massive increase in private indebtedness over the last 15 years or so. Fortunately, Australia has a couple of major advantages. Firstly, our banks were certainly more considered, and you look at the sort of leverage of the big four Australian banks, and they've certainly sort of hovered around the sort of mid to high teens, and whilst we might see them come back a little bit, I think generally the fact that our banking sector has been well publicised is in pretty good shape, certainly relevant to some of the overseas peers. The other advantage that Australia has is that our governments did actually use the good times, so to speak, to deleverage, and what you've seen across the national balance sheets is a significant decline in net debt, and that chart from the most recent budget shows you just what Australian governments have done across both federal and state governments. So we're in a pretty good shape. Our banks are in good shape, and our governments have deleveraged. What is government's role going to be in the deleveraging process? And I think it's pretty obvious, and everybody knows this, that governments must and will increase debt. Essentially, they are going to be the ones acting as something of an economic cushion, as it were, to combat the inevitable decrease in private leverage. There's been a lot of debate around sort of debt, and I don't think the question is so much about how much public debt is the right number, how much should governments borrow, should it be at the state level, should it be at the federal level, and the usual tug of war around that. And it's not even, as John Fitzgerald pointed out, whether it's direct debt or indirect debt, whether it's done through PPPs or long-term financial obligations, all of that counts as debt on the state balance sheet. I think that ultimately what history will judge governments by is what taxpayers get in return. And obviously there's a lot of fiscal stimulus, a lot of job creation. But if we're talking about infrastructure, I think that the infrastructure spending will all be about implementation, and obviously Wal highlighted that earlier this morning. In terms of the whys and the hows, this has already been touched on and I think is pretty self-evident. I mean, I think first and foremost, we are still all about enhancing the long-term productivity of the nation. That is why you deliver infrastructure first and foremost. We're looking to improve service delivery, and obviously we're looking to create jobs and that fiscal stimulus that is has been discussed so often. In terms of the question of how and that obvious debate, and we saw it even this morning, just that conflict between the need for speed and to get these projects out fast and the need for discipline. And I think that discipline is twofold. Firstly, it's obviously picking the right projects and making sure that we're investing in the right forms of infrastructure. Obviously, there are a lot of processes and good government processes to pick the right projects and ensure that we do invest in the right infrastructure. But the second part of it is probably can be summarised by the old sort of residential property saying that don't overcapitalise, and that's really just about making sure that we get value for money, that in terms of that spend we spend it wisely, or we see government spend it wisely, and we don't pay too much for infrastructure and we don't pay for the wrong infrastructure. So the pretty simple job that governments have ahead of them is to deliver job-intensive, highly productive infrastructure. If you could also do it quickly and cost-effectively, that would be great. So it's all pretty easy when you say it like that. So then we get to the question of government spending wisely. That might seem like an unusual thing, but I think that governments can spend wisely. I think they have set out and established good PPP programs, and I think Australia is now held out as a model for procuring infrastructure efficiently. The benefits are all well known, and they've been touched on by others. I mean, there is the design and commercial innovation, cost and time certainty, whole of life performance, and the track record is now there, and John Ampley showed the evidence, if you like, and I've just got a couple of statistics there which probably and hopefully line up with John's around the cost savings and the time savings. The issue, of course, is that this PPP program in the past has mostly been driven, in my mind, by the discipline and innovation of private capital and the difference between traditional public procurement and the PPP procurement. The fundamental difference is the involvement of private capital and the discipline and innovation that brings to the process. If I just get now onto the question of funding, and if we just sort of reminisce for a little bit about how it used to be, way back when there was lots of capital in the system, you had the choice between debt capital markets, bank debt, mezzanine funding and equity, and it was all relatively well priced, and basically that capital used to compete and competed quite aggressively for projects, and the money went looking for a home, and you can see there that there were large pools, relatively cheap, and the marginal cost of that capital really didn't go up as you pulled volume together, because there was just such depth in the market. And so you could essentially create the sort of PPP capital structures that you needed, and there was quite intense competition to come up with the most competitive and innovative capital structure as you drew upon the different pools of capital. Unfortunately, it's a pretty different world these days, as we all know, and now essentially projects are competing for capital. And I've just tried to sort of demonstrate a little bit about what's happened with the market. Certainly the cost has gone up monumentally across the board. Some might argue that some of the markets are almost closed. But I think that the other thing that's happening is that capacity is severely curtailed. And whilst people think just in total absolute capacity, the other thing that is occurring is that the marginal cost of that capital is increasing dramatically as you try to drag the volume together for individual projects. So I think that's one of the fundamental issues that we now have is it's completely turned around, and governments now need to think about how they can recreate that competition, or at least a semblance of it, because as you go chasing that capital, and particularly if you go chasing the volume of capital, the cost of that capital and the marginal cost of that capital undoubtedly increases very substantially, as that chart tries to show. If I move on to onto the question of debt funding, and again this is obviously for social infrastructure, I think the first thing that we just have to be realistic about is the amount of private capacity. There's lots of numbers sort of thrown up, and I think that you know, I've got a couple of numbers there, 200 to 300 million per project. I'm probably looking at the more sort of competitive end of the bank market. I think you can look for more bank debt, and you can probably raise larger volumes, but I think you do run the risk of running into that marginal cost question as you look for more volume. Capital market capacity, everybody will tell you that's dead and non-existent. I don't think that's quite true. I think that it is starting to come back. We're starting to sort of see the very first signs of life offshore for capital market funding for these sorts of projects. It might take a little while before that reaches Australia, but I think it is, if not completely dead, it is still very, very constrained. What governments just have to recognise is that PPPs will compete for debt capital across the spectrum of capital opportunities. Capital is scarce. There are private companies, as we all know, competing for that capital. Governments themselves in their debt programs are essentially competing against private capital that might be applied to PPPs. And then there are just other projects. Each project will compete with other PPP opportunities, both within the states and overseas as well. So there is a lot of competition for that scarce capital. And I do think that we'd be well advised to avoid the marginal cost of debt becoming the cost of debt. And it's a very difficult thing to measure. But when are you starting to run into that problem of marginal cost of debt going up quite significantly? I think the last sort of point on debt that I'll make is that the question really is how much private debt do you need, and ultimately why is the private debt there? And I think that really the primary purpose for the private debt is to ensure that there's proper rigour, discipline and due diligence applied to the bidding and execution process, and ultimately the delivery of the project as well. So really, to put the question back in reverse, is not to ask how much capital is available, but really how much private debt do you need to achieve the objectives that are and the benefits of PPPs. And I think that the real benefits that debt bring is that rigour, discipline and due diligence that capital goes through. And in this environment, that due diligence is even more onerous because capital is so scarce. If we just touch a little bit on what's happening overseas, and obviously every government across the world, particularly those with PPP programs, are asking themselves the same questions that Rory and Jana are asking. But if the UK has just recently announced that they'll set up a unit to lend alongside commercial lenders, and there is also the European Investment Bank that lends alongside two particular projects. And it's particularly targeted at those very large projects where capacity is just such an obvious constraint. There are no doubt some limitations and challenges with such a solution of government authorities lending alongside banks, and there are some interesting inter-creditor issues that those raise in the detail. So we'll see how that unfolds. The French solution is essentially to guarantee up to 80% of a PPP project's debt, so a project vehicle can issue debt, raise debt, and receive a guarantee for 80% of that debt, which essentially makes it sovereign debt, not dissimilar to the way the federal government guarantee is working on local banks. They also permit non-underwritten financing, so that they allow the final sort of underwrite of the finance to occur after the preferred bidder is selected. The Canadian solution is predominantly centred around increasing provincial project contributions. The Canadians have long co-contributed to projects, and their response is largely around increasing both the completion payments but also co-funding during the construction of projects. So that's much more of a direct contribution. They've also expanded their equivalent of ETHIC, their export and lending agency, which previously was only able to lend outside of Canada, is now being allowed to lend inside Canada, and obviously that's the PPP project as well. So I think that, you know, the Australian solution, and I will get to what I think the Australian solution is, but I think that there are elements of that Australia can adopt, but I do think governments do need to think about that solution on debt. In terms of equity funding for social infrastructure, some of you may recall that a number of years ago we all used to talk about the wall of money. There was this wall of money that was just going to flood into infrastructure, and you couldn't get infrastructure projects out there fast enough to meet this wall of money. It seems that maybe the wall of money was actually wallpaper. I don't think that's the case, but there were certainly people are now asking the question, what happened to all that money? I think, and Ian will no doubt answer this much better than I might, but it seems like there have been a lot of rebalancing of portfolios as equity valuations have obviously tumbled. There's been a fair bit of redemption and member switching, which has no doubt challenged liquidity. And then I believe there are also sort of foreign currency hedging and other issues that may have been a drain on liquidity. So whilst there are liquidity issues within the super funds, I think there may well be something of a reluctance to invest in illiquid assets. Hopefully that time will pass soon and we will see more active investment in PPPs. I think that, you know, it almost goes without saying that PPPs remain an ideal investment for superannuation. You know, there's long-term liability matching, there's predictable yield, there's an inflation hedge, and ultimately they are low-risk investments. Everything you would think that superannuation money should be targeting. I think though that rather than calling on government for all of the solutions, I do think that the market probably needs to work a bit harder at creating better conduits between investors and assets. If we believe we have the superannuation pools and we believe that PPP assets are good homes for that superannuation money, I think the market needs to work a little bit harder at creating those conduits. Certainly in the UK, there are a number of funds, both listed and unlisted, a very vibrant both primary and secondary market in PPP, equity PPP investments. And that just hasn't materialised in Australia. I think we're starting to get to the scale where there are enough projects, there are enough equity opportunities. What the market needs to do, to respond to that is just create the better conduits between investors and assets. In terms of conclusion, I don't think there'd be too much debate about Australian governments needing to invest in infrastructure and to deliver infrastructure. I would say that PPPs have proven their worth. And maybe make one small comment that they can in fact be quicker than perhaps they've been of late. I think there does need to be a little bit more discipline in the decision making of government to select a preferred bidder, and I certainly support Wal in his call for faster decision making and getting on with announcing preferred bidders. Social infrastructure can be funded in this climate. It is challenging, but I don't think that it's insurmountable. I really think that governments need to be contributing capital or providing project debt to avoid liquidity premiums and capacity constraints. I think it's inevitable that governments need to do that. The financial obligations that come with private debt are on their balance sheet anyway, as John has explained. I think quite clearly they need to reduce the task of private debt. It doesn't really matter. They only need enough private debt to get that discipline, that rigour, and that due diligence occurring in the process. And then finally, the market needs to respond, as I said, to creating better investment vehicles to connect that superannuation money with PPP assets. And I think that that work is occurring, and hopefully we will see that in the near future. Finally, just to conclude on my slide, I think to get those PPP capital structures to work again, as I said, we will be in constrained times, I'm sure, for a while. in the Australian context, both state governments and federal governments need to think about how they contribute capital to ensure PPPs can continue to be used. I think you can still tap the bank markets and you will still get the discipline from the banks, and there is capacity within the banks. Capital markets, maybe not quite yet in Australia, but I think they will be on their way back. Mezz debt still seems to be available in very small volumes, obviously at increased pricing. And then the final step in the equation is equity. We do need more equity. I still think the superannuation funds have that equity. We need to just create those better conduits to ensure that some of that private equity, some of that superannuation money is flowing into PPP equity investments. That's me. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul, for that very comprehensive coverage of the particular area that you're involved in. Now, questions. We have time for some questions.
Paul, David Byers from CEDA. I just wanted to ask a question, picking up on the last point that you made there, that you described this kind of financing as something which would be very attractive for vehicles for superannuation. What do you think it is that prevents that from happening now? You said that there should be better conduits. Maybe that's one answer. But what else is it that prevents that from happening now?
One of the impediments has always been the bidding processes, and as Wallace has outlined, it is expensive to bid, and typically governments have wanted, you know, very committed sort of funding up front. And I think the superannuation funds just want to invest. They don't want all the business risk that goes associated with bidding. So I think that to a certain degree super funds have been left out a little bit, because they don't want to and probably shouldn't be risking funds to participate in the bid process. I think that's started to change to a degree as we've got sort of bigger projects. But I think ultimately the pooling of assets and getting diversification within pools, so that there's not sort of exposure to single assets as much, will also help, particularly for some of the smaller super funds.